Jane and William Taubman write, "The changes that Gorbachev has been bringing to the USSR, and that reached a crescendo in the first 6 months of 1988, may prove to be more revolutionary than the Russian Revolution itself. We didn't think so when we arrived in Moscow in January. We did when we left in June." The Taubmans are co-authors of the new book, Moscow Spring, a chronicle of their 6 months living with the changes of perestroika. The Taubmans are frequent visitors to the Soviet Union. Bill is a specialist in Soviet politics and is a professor of political science at Amherst College. Jane is an expert in Soviet literature and is an associate professor of literature at Amherst. They and their two children spent the first half of 1988 in Moscow as part of an academic exchange program between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Although the Taubmans think that Gorbachev's reforms are revolutionary, this past Sunday's New York Times seemed to deliver a different message. In the News of the Week in Review, Bill Keller wrote, "In the jury of journalistic opinion, the verdict on Gorbachev's perestroika these days is that it has failed." I asked the Taubmans if they could reconcile these two contradictory observations.
He was referring to the economic side of perestroika, and he was saying something that is quite true, that economic conditions not only have not improved, they have in some ways gotten worse. But the economic is not the only side of perestroika. And when we talked about the potential revolutionary nature of it, we had more in mind the political side, the democratization process which is going on in the Soviet Union, and the glasnost, the openness in the press.
Mm-hmm.
I think that still has the potential to be more revolutionary than the revolution itself, in the sense that the revolution didn't change Soviet or Russian political culture. It didn't bring the democracy that it promised. And what is so exciting about what Gorbachev is attempting is that he is trying for the first time, not just in 70 years, but really in centuries, to nudge, to push, to shove the Soviet Union or Russia in the direction of democracy.
I don't know which of you is the better joke teller in the family, but I'm going to ask one of you, Jane or Bill, to tell the perestroika dog joke. This is you say it's your favorite perestroika joke.
I'm the shaggy dog expert.
Okay, give us.
The American dog turns to a Russian dog and asks, "Tell me about this perestroika of yours." The Russian dog replies wistfully, "Well, they made my chain a lot longer, and I can bark all I want, but they've moved the dinner dish a lot further away."
What's the relevance of that joke to the conditions that you found when you were in the Soviet Union?
Well, as we say in the book, glasnost is relatively easy in a country that has lots of unexpressed ideas and lots of unpublished manuscripts. But perestroika takes a lot more doing. It's going to mean fundamental changes of not only the economy, but the way people think about work and their attitude towards their work.
I think in a sense the revolution, if we can call it that, in the Soviet Union is not so much economic and not even political. It's really social and psychological. We're really talking about an attempt to change the way people think about themselves, about their fellow citizens, about their jobs, change the way they think and they act. And in that sense you can understand how fundamental the effort is, but also how difficult it is.
Bill, when you were trying to go to the Soviet Union this time around during the first few months of perestroika, you had trouble getting permission to stay as long as you wanted to, and you were never really sure whether they were singling you out and they didn't want you to stay that long, or whether it was just the bureaucracy, and you were just one of the people getting caught in the middle of it. Is that still typical in the Soviet Union, that you can't tell whether they're singling you out or whether the bureaucracy is just bogging down?
Well, it still happens that you can't be sure. One of the things that's changed is there now are people in the government officialdom that you meet and talk with whom you can ask, and sometimes they'll even answer. Now, I think the man in the bureaucracy who was giving me a hard time and whom we talk about in the book, he turned out to be a kind of classic Neanderthal, a Stalinist, an anti-Semite. He would never have told me the true story, but he was replaced by much younger people who talked to me quite frankly in a way that they never would have 3 or 4 years ago, and might even have answered a question about why I was being given a hard time.
If they talked to you more frankly than they could have a few years ago, what's an example of what they told you now that they couldn't have before?
Well, this doesn't concern so much me, but rather we tell the story in the book about how one day I dropped by this office where this old man had once reigned supreme and now was replaced by 3 or 4 younger people. And I walked in and found them gossiping But it wasn't office gossip. They were talking about how many millions or how many tens of millions of people Stalin destroyed, liquidated. Now that, in the old days, I'm not sure they ever would have dared talk to each other about that, let alone discuss it in the presence of an American.
Bill, your contacts are more official contacts in the political world in the Soviet Union. Jane, you are an expert in Soviet literature, and your contacts are more in the cultural world.
Right.
What were some of the major differences you saw in what people were willing to tell you and what they were willing to write and to perform in their work?
Well, the big difference, as far as our friends were concerned on this trip, was that the differences began to blend. And indeed, we found by the end of the trip that sometimes when we got tickets to something very desirable, we would invite friends from both groups and introduce one to the other, which we never would have dreamed about doing
before. The big difference was no difference. In the old days, these groups used to be worlds apart in what they would say and certainly what they would say to us. And nowadays, they were on the same wavelength.
What was most exciting for us in this latest trip were a series of meetings, either in Bill's cases, sometimes political discussions, seminars, discussions following the showing of a new and controversial movie, or evenings devoted to the memory or in honor of a writer or singer such as Joseph Brodsky or Alexander Galich, who had emigrated, been previously non-persons.
And at these meetings, you would meet both worlds. You'd meet my friends and Jane's friends. They had crossed over and were now talking to each other as well as to us.
My guests are Bill and Jane Taubman, who are co-authors of the new book Moscow Spring, which described the 6 months from January till June that they spent in the Soviet Union. And this book describes their experiences watching perestroika unfold. Jane, you write that one of the most astonishing changes that you saw in the Soviet Union was that literary émigrés had been legitimized.
Yes. This took place just in the 6 months we were there. The first of them was Brodsky, whose poems were published for the first time in December of 87. And in the 6 months we were there, there was a flood of new names, of old names, which had been non-persons for years, coming back into the Soviet press. They're now talking about publishing Voynovich. They've published Alexander Galich. And there's a great euphoria among their former readers and fans in the Soviet Union that these, I would watch, sit on the subway next to a woman who was happily reading Nabokov's The Gift in Russian while strap-hanging.
Is there still an underground literature?
Not very much, because there's nothing for samizdat to print that really has not been printed in the official media, except for a few obvious exceptions, such as you read in the press the other day, Solzhenitsyn is still beyond the pale, although many journals are fighting for permission to publish his works as well.
There was a piece in this past Sunday's New York Times Sunday Book Review by Craig Whitney about glasnost writing. And he writes, imagine the freedom of being suddenly able to say the things you want to say after years of censorship. And you'll have some idea of both the excitement and the difficulty of being a writer in the Soviet Union today. Did you see that?
Precisely, and I like that article very much. He summed up exactly the predicament. Russian literature, going way back before the revolution, of course, has had to bear the burden of the kind of social discussion that has not been allowed in a more general kind of press. And it's had to do this through a Sapien language, through having readers who are well-trained to read between the lines. And now that many of those restraints are lifted, Russian writers are going to have to learn a whole new art. It's not just exciting enough to get something through and by the censor. They're going to have to decide what they're going to talk about. They'll be more free to be more individual and talk about their own personal concerns. But it's a whole new direction for Russian art, and we don't know yet how that's going to go.
Bill, one of your main projects now is a biography of Khrushchev. What's his current rating in the Soviet Union?
Well, when I think one of the reasons they hesitated to give me a visa for the whole 6 months was that they smelled out that I was interested in Khrushchev. So at that point when we arrived, he was still something of an unperson, although he'd had a couple of mentions. Now his name is everywhere. I was just back in the Soviet Union again in January at this Cuban Missile Crisis conference, and I sat down one evening with one of Khrushchev's children, and they filled me in on the current writing on Khrushchev, and I duly took notes in my notebook, and it filled two pages of references to articles about Khrushchev in the Soviet press.
What does it say that, that officials are looking more favorably on Khrushchev?
Well, Khrushchev was the great reformer, Gorbachev's great predecessor. And, of course, Khrushchev failed. And so it becomes very important for reformers to understand why Khrushchev failed in order, in part, to avoid a similar outcome this time around. So they are intently looking back to see to what extent Khrushchev came up against immovable objects, to what extent his own flaws entered into his failure. On the whole, they also want to praise Khrushchev because if you look back over the 70 years of Soviet power, there aren't that many leaders to praise. Not, certainly not Stalin, clearly not Brezhnev. Andropov maybe, but he didn't live long enough. Chernenko wasn't really alive when he was in power. That leaves Lenin, who of course remains sacred, or mostly so, and Khrushchev. So they have a political reason. It serves the cause of legitimizing the regime to have something good to say about Khrushchev.
You mentioned Stalin. There were debates about Stalinism when you were in the Soviet Union. Is this something new?
Well, there were not only debates. When we arrived, it was still shocking in the first few months to hear people talking about Stalin's crimes.
Comparing Stalinism occasionally to Hitlerism and fascism.
Hitler. Oh, yes. That is now conventional wisdom in the Soviet Union, that Stalin and Hitler were two of a kind. By the time we left, I'd say there was a fairly broad consensus on that, but not entirely. Stalin still has his defenders, and the irony is that many of them are simple people who were Stalin's own victims and who nonetheless seem to feel a kind of nostalgia for Stalin's time.
Bill, you were asked to participate in a debate about Stalin. What kind of diplomacy do you have to use when you're an American in the Soviet Union and you want to discuss the crimes of Stalinism?
Well, that's a question that bothered me a lot at the time, and that I worried over a lot. In the past, I'm frank to admit that I probably, not this time, but in previous years, had been guilty of putting things too gently, using euphemisms. And one of the things that happened last spring was that we decided to take our cue from the Russians, who were telling the truth, and to tell the truth as in unvarnished fashion as possible. So I did that on several occasions. I went in and just sort of socked it to them, talked about Stalin as I understood it. And lo and behold, on a couple of these occasions, rather than fighting back against me, I ended up being told by my Soviet listeners that I hadn't gone nearly far enough and that I'd been too soft on Stalin myself.
I found it interesting that, Bill, after you appeared on Moscow television, you were encouraged to get as much media exposure as possible because it would impress all the low-level bureaucrats that you had to deal with.
Well, the idea is that in a country like that, where everybody works for the state, if the higher-ups in the state seem to be benevolent toward you, to look upon you with favor, then their underlings figure that's now the party line, and they will do the same. So this was advice given to me by somebody who was really rather cynical about the way things worked, and he just wanted me to be equally cynical.
Jane, you made the rounds of some of the theaters to see what was happening, and I was surprised to read that Biloxi Blues, a Neil Simon play that was later turned into a movie in the States, was the most popular play in Moscow.
Well, it was very popular, and it was done at one of the very good new theater studios, the Tabakov Theater Studio. And I write in the book the way in which the theme of Judaism had a particular resonance for the Soviet audience, that the music, which was blues music in the American production, was replaced in the Soviet production with klezmer music, the Jewish music of Eastern Europe.
Because one of the soldiers is a Jew in the American army and is getting a hard time. And, of course, for Soviet audience used to reading, as Jane said before, between the lines, they understood that the people who put on the play were talking about the Soviet army and also about the treatment of Jews in the Soviet Union.
And I asked someone in the theater administration the naive question, gee, why did you choose this particular play? And they looked back at me with a grin and said, we think it says some important things about the relationship of man and the army. And, of course, doing this through an American play, ostensibly about the American army in World War II, Soviet viewers who are trained to do this know exactly what they're talking about.
This is still a sign of how far things have to go, the fact that they couldn't put on a play yet about abusive treatment of recruits in the Soviet army. They had to address that question indirectly through a Neil Simon play about the American army.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about reading between the lines. You both read a lot of newspapers and magazines. You read whatever you can, I'm sure, when you're in the Soviet Union. And Jane, you had to get to the newspaper stands at, 6:30 in the morning in order to be able to pick up the newspapers you wanted?
Yes, we were quickly told that we could subscribe to things, but it took a month for our subscriptions to start, and that was a cold, long February. I tried everything, including bribing the little man who ran the kiosk. One of the ironies of Perestroika and of Glasnost and its success is that people are reading phenomenally. They're reading everything they can get their hands on, and the really interesting publications are sold out very early in the morning. I was there at 7 o'clock one morning, and sure enough, there was a line of 20 or 30 people in the pre-dawn darkness.
And they're reading in a way to see which way are things swinging, and they're reading between the lines to find it out. Yeah,
actually, one of the big changes is that they no longer have to read between the lines.
They just have to stand on them.
Because the lines themselves are so interesting. In the old days, as Americans specializing on the Soviet Union, we knew that there wasn't much to read in the Soviet press, and you'd look for hints here and there. You'd read between the lines. Nowadays, the Soviet press is full of stories, of pieces, articles that are interesting in their own right. They're not simply interesting because they tell you something about how, let's say, the Soviets feel about this or that subject. They illuminate the subject.
Well, one of the most talked about pieces while you were in the Soviet Union was by Nina Andreeva. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Nina Andreeva.
Thank you. And she's a conservative and wrote a piece condemning Perestroika. And the big subject of controversy was whether the party was behind the peace or not.
Yes, her piece, which filled half a page in one of the newspapers of the Party Central Committee, seemed to many of our friends to be a signal. In the old days, it would have been a signal. What the signal they assumed it was that the reforms were finished and that either Gorbachev was on the way out or he himself had decided to reverse his field and retreat. And so thinking that that's what the article meant, an awful lot of people clammed up. They stopped talking. They stopped calling us. And for 3 weeks, you had a kind of preview of what may happen if and when the reforms are reversed. But luckily, this time, it was a false alarm.
And how did you know it was a false alarm?
Well, we all knew it was a false alarm because 3 weeks after the appearance of this piece, another broadside appeared, this time in the most important paper of all, Pravda, an attack on Nina Andreeva. We have a chapter in the book called Pravda to the Rescue. And our own feeling about this was highly ambivalent because on the one hand, we were greatly reassured, as were our friends, that Pravda had re-endorsed the reforms. But on the other hand, it was not reassuring to realize that it took Pravda's re-endorsement before people dared continue to speak freely.
But the psychological results of that were very interesting. It was as if people were annoyed to look at their own fear during those 3 weeks. And the change in mood after the Pravda article was amazing.
Realizing how impotent they had been in the face of this false alarm, it was as if they took a vow to fight harder and not to be intimidated again. And so for the month or so after the Pravda piece appeared in April of 88, it was as if all hell broke loose, and suddenly the press was filled with pieces far more daring and far-reaching than any before Nina Andreeva.
Jane, it was your observation that frequently in the Soviet Union it was women who upheld the status quo during the changes of Perestroika, and I think this disturbed you, and you tried to understand why this was happening.
It did puzzle me. We have a chapter in the book called Feminism? And some of it relates to Nina Andreeva. For instance, I would ask some of Bill's political friends if they thought it peculiar or interesting that it was a woman who happened to be the author of this crucial piece, and they thought, gee, no, never thought about that. At Oganyok, the most liberal magazine, we were told that up to 90% of the writers of pro-Stalinist letters were women. And I was puzzled by that and asked why they thought so, and I got a kind of semi-flip answer, longing for a strong man. And the whole question of a cut between our usual stereotypes, women are, on the one hand, admitted to professions which we in the United States still see as masculine professions. They're chemists, they're doctors. Yet, on the other hand, there's a great conservatism, and even among the women, a great longing for more traditional roles in the family, more respect for their roles in the home, but also for men to take a stronger role in the family, and a fear that men will lose their masculinity with too much feminism.
I would imagine that in the Soviet Union now, there's a lot of testing. Where are the limits? If the limits are broader than they were before, where do they lie? And how do you know if you're crossing the line? I guess you find that pretty soon if you're crossing the line.
Well, that is exciting. I used to use the metaphor of a cow standing in a field surrounded by an electric fence, that since she doesn't know she's reached it until she hits it and gets the pain, she stays a cautious way away from it. And many Soviets had done exactly that. And now they're finding where those boundaries are and finding that the boundaries in many cases aren't there at all.
Well, I would add two things. One is that it's hard to know where the limits are. And for many people who you would think would be glad that the limits are no longer clear, it's somewhat unnerving not to know where they are. And the other thing I would add is that I think many Russians, reform-minded Russians, have come to the conclusion that the limits in part depend on them, and that the bolder they are, the braver they are, the more daring they are in what they say and do, the more likely it is that the limits will be expanded. And so they're taking heart from their own courage and in the process extending the boundaries of the possible.
But the limits are not just political. For instance, the traditional near-Puritan attitudes in the Soviet press and Soviet literature on treatment of erotic themes. A much talked about movie, Little Vera, which came out only at the end of last year, has, as far as I know, one of the first semi-nude sex scenes in Soviet film. It's also a darn good movie without that. But many people are troubled by the falling of what they saw as worthwhile traditional boundaries. And people who see these traditional things falling are upset by the changes of perestroika.
Boris Yeltsin's campaign has been in the headlines in the American press. He's the former Moscow city party chief who lost his job over a year ago. Now he's running for office, and he's accusing the party of using dirty tricks to prevent his election. Do you think that his campaign is a sign that reform can only go so far, that he's too radical, he's more radical than the liberal reforms, and therefore they don't want him in office?
Well, you know, we'll know the answer to that on Sunday night, or whenever the votes are counted. The elections are March 26th in the Soviet Union, and we'll see whether he wins. I have no doubt whatsoever that the party officials would like him to lose, and I have no doubt either that they have ways and means of ensuring that outcome. But on the other hand, it would be highly embarrassing, damaging for the world to conclude, and for many of Yeltsin's supporters to conclude, that he'd been cheated out of his rightful place in the parliament. So I think they're on the horns of a dilemma. I think they're trying to figure out what to do, and we'll know what they decided by Sunday night or Monday.
But he certainly is wildly popular among everyone we knew. Indeed, one of the only Samizdat document I was given there was a copy that purported to be Yeltsin's speech at the meeting the previous fall when he had been forced out of the Politburo. Interestingly enough, Western journalists refused to publish this because they thought it was a falsification, but our Soviet friends were persuaded simply by the passionate attack on the bureaucracy that it was indeed legitimate.
Mm-hmm. We were told that kids in courtyards are playing a game called Yeltsin, in which one kid is, it's like cowboys and Indians, one kid is the fugitive, namely Yeltsin, and the other kids chase him down and try to punish him.
Have you noticed new attitudes in the United States toward the Soviet Union with glasnost?
Absolutely. It's what we call Soviet chic, and I think the cover that our publisher designed for our book typifies it. Our Moscow Spring is written out in beautiful rainbow colors, and we think back to a series of earlier books on the Soviet Union, which inevitably had lots of red and heavy brass hammer and sickles.
I think Americans want to believe the best about what's going on in the Soviet Union, and one of the paradoxes that you encounter, we encountered ourselves, is that Soviets who are themselves fighting for change were constantly telling us to lower our expectations and warning us that we might be victims of illusions. That is, the very people who are fighting for reform kept telling us, now, don't put too much hope in what we're fighting for. And that was both, I think, an indication of their attitude, but also a kind of warning sign Because if the people who are on the cutting edge of change don't have confidence in what they're doing, it risks becoming a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy.
What do you think the odds are that perestroika will bring permanent change, a more permanent openness to the Soviet Union?
Well, I think that too much of the Western and American discussion about this is polarized between those who say Gorbachev is going to succeed and those who say he's going to fail and it's going to be a disaster. You know, if people who look down the road 10 years and say either the Soviet Union is going to be a Western-style democracy or it's going to go back to Stalin, it seems to me that neither outcome is as likely as the fact that the Soviet Union in 10 years will look more or less the way it looks now. That is changed, still changing, but neither having become like us nor having reverted back.
Okay, well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.